Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Blaser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another great episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Our topic tonight is going to be talking to a developer about his recent experience with both mobile and PC game development and what's going into transitioning his first major release from a mobile launch to the PC. He recently wrote some posts on Gonwa Sutra on the subject, and I'm sure this is going to be a great cast talking to him. So, please welcome from Roach Interactive, lead designer Raul Sagat, and I'm going to let him announce his name as well, because I'm pretty sure I just butchered it pretty well, too.
Hey, Josh, that was not too bad, Rahul Sehgal, but it's like I said, it's a tough name to pronounce. So that was pretty acceptable. Good job.
Well, as long as I get pretty acceptable, that's good. I have a guess with another very hard pronounced name. He said that I got like the closest to saying it, so I'm happy with that. If I can get at least like 70-80% of the way there, I'll consider that a success in my
book. Yeah, that was 75. That was 75 for sure.
All right, thanks, Rahul. So, it's a pleasure to have you on the cast today. And for those of you listening, Raul is in India. I believe you are my first guest from the game industry in India.
Thank you. It's absolutely a pleasure to be on Game Wisdom. I discovered your blog a short while ago, and it's kind of like become, it's part of my reading list now. You know, I really like going through it. So, it's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast, Josh.
Thanks, Raul. It's great to hear that. I love to be able to put out content like this on Game Wisdom. And as we talked about before the cast, there really isn't a lot of discussions of this caliber regarding game design. And you had a really good tagline about the art and science of games.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the fact that I've actually been teaching at a game college for about 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, I had some ideas when I went to teaching, and I've actually been kind of figuring out how people learn how to make games. So that's been a big point, right? The science is, it's not something that anyone can teach you. It's something that you develop a feel for. Mm-hmm. when you teach and you start making games. So yeah, so that's it's a work in progress, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely a science. It's definitely a science in there somewhere.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. I'm going to see if we can adopt that as part of like our tag for the site too, because it sounds just so brilliantly simple that I can't believe I didn't think of it this whole time. But let's get to our cast tonight. Again, it's great to have you on, Raul, and I believe our conversation is going to be very interesting. As I said a few seconds ago, we're going to be talking about your upcoming game, Bird of Light, and some of the challenges that you've had, not just with creating it originally for the mobile space, but then taking that and moving it to the PC. As I said on our precast talk, a lot of the developers who I've spoken to have talked about going in the opposite direction, taking a game that was either going to be released on the PC or already released, and then figuring out ways to, I guess, fit that into the mobile market. So I'm pretty sure this is going to be a very interesting discussion we're going to have later in the cast.
I'm sure we will.
So to get the ball rolling, then, Raul, since this is your first time on the cast, for people listening who may not have heard of you or your studio, could you talk a little bit about your background at your studio as well as your game industry experience?
Sure. So about 8 years ago, I used to be in the Merchant Marine. I used to be a Merchant Marine officer, and I used to be a navigational officer, certified captain on a ship, on a cargo ship. And, you know, I was doing that for a long time. And one fine day, I used to play games, and I used to write, and I had a creative streak, and I started really hate my job, and I wanted to do something else. So it was, I don't know, one fine morning, I just woke up and said, I want to make games, man. I'm out of here. So I took a course in Vancouver, in Canada, and that was a game design course at Vancouver Film School. And that's it. I was there for a year, and after that, I did an internship at a company in Vancouver. I didn't have a work permit, so I was literally working for free. almost like for 6 months or so. And then I managed to get a game designer's job back here in India. So I moved back to India, Vancouver. And but I wasn't happy with what I was doing because I wasn't really, I mean, there's not a lot of, at least at that time, there wasn't a lot of creativity in the game industry over here. It was mostly back-end work, and I wasn't happy with that. So in a year, I quit my job, and I managed to find part-time work teaching at a game college. That's really helped me financially and every which way. Just keeping it, just being in the industry, keeping me in touch. You know, my teaching has really been a big deal. So I quit my job and I started up my own game studio and I started teaching. And I mean, it was just me at the time. And it was really hard to find a good team. You know, I mean, for I think 3 years, I was, you know, asking my students to work with me. I was trying freelancers, but it's like it was so hard to actually find my team. You know, because I'm a designer. And I'm not a terrible artist, but I can hold my own. Like, I can throw together a sketch. I can make a mock-up in Photoshop. I can make a terrible 3D mesh and texture it and, you know, and put a fusion map on it. I can do that, but I can't code at all. Like, I can code like a chicken can fly, you know, really badly and only when I have to save my life. Yeah. So... yeah, so I after about 3 years, I've managed to find someone, a friend of mine, who's a programmer, who works with me full time now, and it's pretty much the two of us, and both of us teach, right? So that kind of helps. So we teach and we kind of work from home, and we have this little game company, and everyone else is either a contractor or we kind of say, you know what, I'll give you a stake in the game, so make some art for us, please, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty much that's Roach Interactive. I mean, the name is Roach because you know, we're cockroaches. We survive, you know, on absolutely the minimum. We want to make good games, and we will survive to make good games. That's why we are Roach Interactive.
Great, and it's interesting about how you talk about your own experience and your own skill level role, because I think I'm a lot along those lines. I can't code either. My brain just doesn't work at that level. I can spend like the next 5 hours discussing mechanics, philosophy. I can tell you exactly how the game will work. I can even give you the high level thought about how it would be programmed. But if you say, okay, Josh, and I'll sit and type it all up in Unity, I'll be like, it ain't working there.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, for me as a designer, it just, I used to be so jealous of people who could write code because I had all these ideas in my head that I could do nothing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it was this feeling of helplessness, like, I want to make this, but my brain doesn't let me, you know?
Yes.
And I tried. I really tried. Like, I tried to do all these online courses, and then I just realized it was just not worth it. I would be struggling so much to write the code, so, you know. And the funny thing is that after I had given up on finding someone else, I said, you know what, let me just do this myself. And once I did that, I found someone, you know. So that was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always how it works. The second you give up, it's either a feast or famine, I think, as the saying goes.
Yeah, you're right.
So, I guess my next question then is, since you are my first developer from India, and as I like to ask all my international guests, what is, I guess, the current state of the game industry where you're at? Is it growing? Are you the only, like, main studio around? I guess for our audience, could you give us, like, a sense of how the industry is doing where you're at?
Sure. That's a good question, actually. Mm-hmm. So we generally have three levels of studios. Mm-hmm. One of the big fish, right? So we have Electronic Arts, we have Ubisoft, who have these big studios with hundreds of people in our big cities. And they're mostly doing a lot of outsourcing here, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of QA,
yeah.
You know, part of the project. Like, they maybe do the UI of a mobile game, right? So, but then, I mean, they're big employers. There's lots of people employed there with good jobs, with good salaries. But it's just, I mean, I was with GameLoft. I know what it's like. So it's not creatively challenging. It's a secure job, but it's not creatively challenging. Like you're doing a tiny part of a huge project that's been run somewhere else in the world. And if you're like me, that's just not good enough. You know, I mean, it's not good enough for me. And then there's the other smaller studios, homegrown, right? Homegrown studios that started off, say, 5-6 years ago. And they're making mostly mobile, not mostly, all. They're all the medium, large funded studios, the guys with money and some funding and investors. They're all making mobile games. And at the other end are the indies, right? Now, honestly, the indies is where there's lots of good stuff going on. But again, I would say it's a 90% mobile development market. There are very, very few studios who are actually making PC or console games, right?
Yeah.
But generally, a basic fundamental problem we have in the Indian game industry is, I like to call it, vegans running steakhouses.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It's like the problem is that gaming, playing video games is not as culturally embedded as it is, for example, in the US,
mm-hmm.
right? So I would say kids have been playing video games here, like seriously playing video games here for the last 10 years,
mm-hmm.
right? Before that, video games was very, very niche. It's kind of gone mainstream about, say, 5 to 10 years ago. So you don't have many, 30, 40-year-olds who grew up with video games.
Yeah.
Right? It's the 20-somethings who actually know video game culture really well. So the problem is that people at, I know, for example, in the US, that there are VCs, there are CEOs, there are like 40, 45-year-old executives at game companies that have, you know, that grew up making games. So you can give them a game and they would look at it as a player first,
mm-hmm.
and then they would look at it as a business owner,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. So the ability to evaluate a video game as a player is really important as business. You know, mm-hmm. if I'm a businessman, how do I know a game is good?
Yeah.
I need to be able to play it. I need mm-hmm. to be able to understand what video games are. And that is something just severely lacking in India, right? So that is why it's, I don't have much hope from the larger companies. I'm not impressed with the work that they've been putting up at all. It's not innovative enough. It's not brave enough. And you need to be brave in this industry, man. Like, you really need to take risks.
Yep.
You need to be able to fail. And it's not exciting. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the 20-something, the 25-year-olds, the 22-year-olds, these guys are getting together in small groups and doing some really good work, you know. So that's where the really good work in India is happening, from the indies. There's some money in big games in India, but it's the indies where you're going to see the successful games, the good games come out of. So that's pretty much it. It's kind of changing pretty rapidly, but it's going to take a bit of time, I think, for something path-breaking and good to come out there. Because even for indies, it takes a while, right, to figure things out. It's a
yeah.
really hard profession to be in. So I would say a year or two, man, you should see some good independent games coming out of India
yeah.
for PC and for mobile.
It's interesting hearing what you said about the state of the Indian game industry. Well, when we talk to a lot of the guests around here, one second, mm-hmm. it's that damn door. Okay. When we talk to a lot of the guests around here, either in the United States or in Canada, I'm talking to guys who have been in the industry for like the last either they've been there for their mid-30s or even later than that. The people who grew up with the older systems, who have that history and that legacy of being able to look at these games and figure out what's made them so popular. And I think you said a really good point there that a lot of people have trouble looking at a video game both from a business perspective and from a consumer or a game perspective, figuring out what makes it work. Why is a game good? Why is a game bad? And
yes,
that's one of the things I've been trying to explore and expand upon with Game Wisdom, with these podcasts and posts. Because, again, these are topics that it's not exactly art, it's not exactly science, it's definitely somewhere in between. And you really need to have your feet in like both ponds, I guess, to understand everything fully. And it's one of the things that we've spoken about in previous casts that you really need to wear both hats. You need to be an artist. You need to be able to think of something creative. As you said, Raul, be able to take those risks and make something amazing. But at the same time, you also need to have a sense of business. You need to understand, how am I going to sell this game to people? Because if you can't sell the game, then it doesn't matter all the creativity in the world if no one's going to play it, no one's going to be able to find it on any digital platform or with poor marketing.
Yes, yes, true. I mean, the thing is, as a developer, I constantly have to keep shifting between businessman and player.
Yeah.
Right? I have to satisfy both of them. The businessman has to be satisfied, and then I got to put on my player's hat. Am I happy as a player? Mm-hmm. No. Okay, I got to do some more work. Am I happy as a businessman? No, I got to do some work on that. So it's kind of like this. You have to keep switching hats between businessman, developer, and player, and keep evaluating your game, your own work on all these counts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think another good point you talk about, which I think we'll also infer later on in this cast, is talking about the fact that the state of the Indian game industry is focusing primarily on mobile at the moment. As we said earlier, your first game, Bird of Light, was originally going to be a mobile game. And since then, you guys have made the decision to transition that to the PC due to some of the issues and quirks that you found with creating a game for the mobile market.
Yes, yes, exactly. The truth is that we are core gamers, right? My team, my programmer, and we are the ones who made the game. And since we are in the mobile environment, and the first game I ever made, Roach Interactive ever made, was mobile. It was a game called Star Trail. It was kind of natural. It was this inertia of mobile that just brought us into saying, okay, I'm going to make a mobile game. You know, I didn't really give it a second thought. You know, I said, I'm going to make a game. And it's going to be a mobile game. You know, so what happened was that we ended up making a core game, you know, because mobile games these days, no disrespect, but you can pick up a mobile game and in about 3 or 4 minutes of gameplay, you know exactly what's on. It's pretty much the same mechanic that repeats itself forever, you know, and Bird of Light is kind of not like that. Bird of Light is a really quirky, organic game that we have made over a period of 2 years, you know, and when we were making it, we pretty much made a game for ourselves, you know, and we are core gamers, you know, we like depth in our games. I like a mechanic that reveals itself 2 hours, 3 hours into gameplay. I like that, you know, I like knowing that there's something that I can unlock, there's something, a new ability, something radically new that I'm going to be doing 3 hours, 4 hours into the game, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what Bird of Light is. So we made it a game with a lot of depth, replayability, and we found that it was a game that kind of, it was really difficult to market, you know. Mm-hmm. publishers kind of pretty much told us that, you know, this game is difficult to market because it crosses and blends genres. Mm-hmm. It's a puzzle game. At the same time, it's an action game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it also has a pretty deep story. And we don't have a game. In mobile, they like templates, you know. They like these, excuse me. Mm-hmm. They like these templates. They like these slots that they can put their games into.
Because
mm-hmm. they can explain what a game is in about 3 seconds to a player. You know, if it takes 15 seconds to explain, that's not going to work
mm-hmm.
Mobile. And we discovered that, you know, a lot of people are interested because the visuals are interesting. And people say, hey, cool visuals, let me have a look at this game. And then they're like, whoa, this game is complicated, man.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it has a female protagonist. It has a little girl. And it doesn't have guns. And mm-hmm. it doesn't have violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was pretty much, we were getting that from everyone. We were getting that from some really big names. Everybody looked at the game and said, hey, we want to check this out. Send us a build. And it was happening a lot, you know. So we had to really look at our own game. And I looked at it and I said, you know what, this is not a mobile-style game. But forget about anything else. The core of the game, the mechanics, the depth, the way the game unfolds is more suited towards someone who's much more committed to playing a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And where are we going to find someone? PC, mm-hmm. you know? And to be honest, like, we were so focused on mobile. I pretty much just, the only game I have time for these days is TF2, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even enter the Steam store. I just like launch TF2 and play it, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? Let me see what's up on Steam. You know, I haven't been on Steam in ages, so let me see what's up on Steam. And I went on Steam. I hadn't been on Steam in like years, literally. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. There's lots of games here, like Bird of Light. Look at that. Look at the reviews. People like this kind of thing. You know, and suddenly just said to me, hey, you know what? We could totally put Bird of Light on PC. People would appreciate it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then, so I found a few publishers and I kind of got some screenshots together and I emailed them and voila, they're like, this is great. Let's do this,
mm.
you know?
Yeah.
So it was a huge revelation for us, you know? It was like, we found our people, you know.
Yeah,
yeah. It was that kind of moment for us.
And a lot of great thoughts to unpack and process there, all regarding the challenges of releasing a game on the mobile versus the PC. I want to talk more about that, but I think to help the audience and sort of frame this discussion more, let's talk a little bit more about the gameplay of what Bird of Light is, and that will help us. That will help us sort of, I think, expand on this part of the conversation. So, obviously, I've been taking a look at the game. I read your post. It sounds very amazing. But for people listening to this cast who haven't heard of the game yet, I know one of the main points of our previous discussion wasn't about the fact that it can't be easily explained. But for people listening, could you give us a little bit of idea of what exactly is Bird of Light?
All right. So, this explanation, like, has been not easy to come by. We have a GDC, we have a Game Developers Conference in India,
mm-hmm.
and my partner, he actually attended GDC with the game. This was in November, and he was at that time. We were calling it a platformer. We were saying that it's a 3D puzzle platformer, right? And he showed this game to somebody, and the guy, he played the game, said, oh, you made a sandbox runner, right? And I was like, yeah, yeah, that's exactly what this is. You define my game better than I could define it, you know?
You just did the same thing with Game Wisdom before the cast. It's amazing, you know, when you have someone else like talk about your thing. It's like, Why didn't I see that? Why didn't I think of that?
Exactly, like what we actually made, we made a sandbox or we made an open world runner, you know, but we hadn't realized what we had. So he's like, oh yeah, you can pretty much build. So, okay, so what Bird of Light is a game where you have a game world. It's basically a bunch of floating islands with paths on them, right? Mm-hmm. And you have a number of floating islands that are fixed, and you have a certain number of bridge tiles that you can actually connect these floating islands with, mm-hmm. right? So they put two parts to the game. First of all, you've shown these floating islands in a top-down view on a grid, and you've got to actually select your bridge tiles, and you've got to connect these islands whichever way you want, right? And once you've connected them, and the point of connecting them is to go from point A to point B, collect some things, and reach the castle, which is on one of these floating islands. And once you've decided your path, you got to start running. So it goes from top-down puzzle to a 3D runner, kind of like, think of it as Temple Run, mm-hmm. right? So there are two phases. We call them the puzzle phase and the action phase, right? So once you have to make your path, and then you have to run that path, right? Okay. So that, in a nutshell, is what Bird of Light is. Like I said, it's not easy to understand it, even after I describe it. So perhaps, you know, watching the trailer or watching the visuals, one would understand better. It's been a challenge to make a game like this, because it's... since there's absolutely nothing, like really nothing like it out there, it's really hard to give a comparison to people. It's like, no, it's not like that at all, man. You just got to play the game, you know? Yeah, that's the hard part about it.
Yeah. I guess my one question I have from that description, well, as you said, there's two parts of Bird of Light. You have the puzzle side where you're building the cores, or you're building the layout of the level, and then you have the runner aspect when you're actually moving through it. When the player is running through the level, do they have complete control of their character, or is it like a, I'm sorry, or do you define like a fixed path through the actual level?
Well, each square, the whole game world consists of these squares, right? And the game world is just a bunch of paths, right? And you can run those paths again and again and again. So, I mean, there is a track on which the player runs. Mm-hmm. Right, but there's the whole game world consists of squares with these tracks on them. It's like a hash, you know, like you have a hash sign. Mm-hmm. Each square has a hash sign of tracks on it, and all the squares connect on all sides.
Okay.
Right. So, did I answer a question?
Yeah, I think so. I'm looking at the screenshot of it now on the site. Okay, so. When you lay down the different squares and the different tracks, you're basically just running along those tracks. And the point of the game is essentially, I was reading your post on Gamasutra about it, there's a lot of advanced challenges that rely on the player optimizing how they design the play space.
Yeah, exactly. So you can kind of find the most obvious path. And there's a bunch of things, not a bunch of things, I have... another thing I wanted to avoid coins. I mean, not that I have anything against coins, but I'm just sick of coins in games. You know, I'm like, I don't want coins in my game. You know, let's make it eggs, right? So there are a number of eggs, say five or six eggs. Which are the eggs? The eggs of the Bird of Light, actually. And the protagonist has to find and collect all these eggs, and they are spread all over the place, right? So, but you don't have to collect these eggs. You can collect them if you like, but you can just, there's a key to the castle. You can just find the key and go straight to the castle. That's fine, not a problem. But you got to do that the best possible way, you know, the fastest way. You got to place the tiles right, and you got to run right? Mm-hmm. Or you can take your time, you can run wherever you want, you can make all the mistakes, all the wrong turns, as long as you find and you collect all the eggs. That's fine too, mm-hmm. right? So you can do a speed run, or you can just be an explorer and collect all the eggs and all the pickups. That's fine too. You can come back to the level later on and do a speed run, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like each level can be completed three different ways. And then there's another way, which is called the boss run, in which you have to get all the eggs in the shortest possible time. So that's hard, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you gotta place the squares just so, and you can't take a wrong turn. You take a wrong turn, you take a wrong jump, and you're out of time. Like you miss that that particular speed run. So there's basically three ways that you can that you can complete each level, and there's 21 levels like that.
Mm-hmm. And as you said a few minutes ago, Raul, that you also have the mechanics grow over the game. So it's not just you doing the same exact thing after, you know, 3 minutes of play. You explore those mechanics, you grow them. I know in the post you made, there's actual like new squares that become unlocked, which in turn unlock new strategies and ways to build the later levels.
Yeah, so I mean, you start off by just like by placing these bridges and running over them, right? So you have these islands that just connect with these bridges, and you need to run over these bridges to connect to the islands. And after level 7, you get a leap function. So you can actually leap over one tile gap, mm-hmm. right? So you can, so then suddenly you don't, you need to place tiles in such a way you actually can run, jump over gaps, like this huge leap that you can take. So that changes the game entirely, you know. Mm-hmm. The way you place tiles is different now. The way you run is different now. The things that you can do is completely different, right? Mm-hmm. And 7 levels later, with these bridges, you actually get to teleport, right? So you get these pairs of teleporters that you can place anywhere in the level, and you can with these bridges, you can actually teleport to different parts of the level. So again, that changes the game completely, because now your tile placement has changed. It's a combination of leaping and teleporting, right? And then the last twist, so to speak, is that the pickups, they used to be static, right? And now the pickups are moving. They start moving in the air, they start moving up and down, they start moving left and right. So it gets harder and harder to actually get all the pickups in one go, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's where the speed run comes in, you know what I mean? Because when you have moving pickups, you also need a bit of luck to be at the right place to get a pickup. Because it's moving, it's like going up in the air and coming down. So it's kind of, it gets pretty hard. I'm not kidding you. There have been times when I've been trying to time a level of my own, mm-hmm. and my own level. I've taken an hour and a half to complete my own level. You know, at that point, I really questioned if I was doing the right thing by making it that hard. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess we'll find out when it releases.
And again, I think inferring back when we just talked about with the state of the mobile industry, Bird of Light definitely sounds like something that, again, it's something that's not easily described, but it sounds very fascinating. And as you said a few minutes ago, it was a very interesting journey, essentially finding those people, finding the audience for that game. And I think what's also very interesting, coincidental kind of fashion is, we talked about this before on the cast, but you also made a post on Gamasutra regarding subjective difficulty, and as you were just saying, design the game around different skill levels, and I actually wrote an article on Gamasutra about 2 to 3 years ago on that very same topic, of designing a game so that different people at different skill levels can play the game, and so that one skill level is not being burdened or forced along by another.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, that was, it's something that, it was very pointed, you know, like, especially for the mobile space. And that, again, actually, it's a very positive side effect of designing for mobile. Mm-hmm. If I had started designing for PC to start with, this probably wouldn't be in there. The game would just straight up be hard, mm-hmm. right? But designing for mobile, I was very aware of the fact that people would come and play the game who would not necessarily be core gamers. Like, they would get frustrated if they died 5 times. So, and the way mobile works is that you need to keep your players engaged, right? It was supposed to be a freemium game, free game. So, I mean, if I lose those casual players within 5 minutes, I don't make any money, right? So my whole point was, you know what? Even if someone kind of casual comes in, I need to keep them engaged for an hour so I can at least make a couple of bucks off them, you know? And this is basically why I really we managed to put subjective difficulty in, so that if I have a casual player come in, he'll be happy for an hour before he's like, all right, this is too hard, I'm leaving. If a hardcore player comes in, straight off the bat, within about 15 minutes of the game, he'll be like, wow, this is hard, I like it, you know. So it was really a challenge to actually satisfy both these players, and I think we've managed to do that. Like, we have two ends of the spectrum. Like, we have stuff in there, both of them at the same time, and that's something I'm pretty happy about. And it's a side effect of mobile. What can I say? Thank you, mobile.
And subjectivity is definitely not something easy to do because, as you're saying, Roald, you're essentially creating the same game for different palettes, for different skill levels. And very few game developers, very few games I can think of off the top of my head, have managed to go that route. When I wrote that post, I think it was like 2, 3 years ago, I think the two examples that I used were something like Demon's Souls and Super Mario Galaxy, and how they're designing the game so that different players will be able to experience the game differently. But at the same time, you're still sticking to one core mechanic, one main form of progression. It's just that it allows you to do different things with it. Another great example that I wish I included back then would be the game Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts, which was released on the Xbox 360. I can't even remember what year, it's been too long. But they also did something like that where you could play the level one way, just, get through. It doesn't matter if it took you 2 hours to get through. You can get through it, you beat the level. But then there's the higher challenge. Now get through the level doing something else. Okay, now get through the level doing something else and do within 5 minutes. And again, you're not punishing one section of your players. If, they can't play the game at the highest level, they're obviously going to still be able to play the game, but you also reward those who learn the game and learn those mechanics and say, oh, there's something for me. If I want to spend 2, 3 hours on this level and completely master it, there I can be rewarded that way. So I'm not being I don't have to wait, 30 levels before the game gets hard. I can make the game as easy or as hard as I want by following these specific challenges.
Yeah, true, very true. Banjo-Kazooie, I mean, after, because I didn't play, but I do know a few of my beta testers who are like, man, this is kind of like Banjo-Kazooie. I like it. And I was like, huh, okay, that's cool, that's nice, and that's a big name game, and I'm happy, that that it's kind of similar. So yeah, I heard about, I mean, I heard about Banjo-Kazooie for sure. And yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty similar. But that being said, the game hasn't been, it hasn't gone out there yet, So I'm for sure we are going to need to tune it, How hard is the hard and how easy is the easy? We'll see soon. I'm definitely looking to get some good beta testing in at the end of it. So that needs to be tuned. I'm not really sure if that is gonna hit the spot, but that might need a bit of fine tuning, because I always, I mean, and I made a blog post about this as well. The first game that I made, started, it primarily failed because it was too hard. It was just, it's a default thing that I do. I make a level, I make it insanely hard. I design it at very hard, and I give it to someone else, and they die, and they die, and I'm like, all right, I need to tune this down. So first thing I do is I bring down the difficulty by 50%. It's something that I you know, I've come to terms with that's the kind of designer I am. I will make something really hard, and then I will tune it halfway down. You know what I mean? And I mean, as a designer, as a level designer, as a game designer in this game, my challenge has been not to frustrate players too much. That's a huge challenge for me as a designer, you know.
Yeah.
But then again, I enjoy that challenge. As a player, you know, I leave a game unless I have that level of frustration. You know what I mean? But then again, you know, as a designer, you would understand that you want frustration, but you want the player to be frustrated as at his or her own inability and not at the game. You want the player to say, I'm not good enough to do this. And not, man, this is unfair. You know, that's not what you want the player to think. You want the player to think, I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. That's the point, right?
100% agree with you there, Ol. It's one of the things I see a lot with developers who struggle with getting that difficulty balance just right. When the player feels that it's the game's fault that they're losing, whether it's because the difficulty is either balanced too high, maybe the abstraction, the numbers are just too off, then the player feels like, it doesn't matter what I do if the game is screwing me, so I'm just going to give up. But if the player feels like, okay, I'm not doing this because maybe I haven't gotten the timing for jumping right, or maybe I haven't figured out how this specific mechanic works, then that keeps them engaged to learn it, and over the course of play, they may go from being, you know, beginner to moderate to expert. And some of the best games allow for that sense of growth. Going back to, I would say, like Super Mario Galaxy, I think that's a masterclass example of walking through different players of different skill levels, but still letting players learn as they go. They did a really good job of spreading out the mechanics so that if someone eventually learns these things, they can go back and then reapply them. But as you're saying, Raul, with getting that balance right, it's something that's very hard for game developers to do, because when you're stuck in your own head for 8 to 10 hours a day building this game, it's hard for you to see how would someone brand new approach this versus how would someone who's an expert get through this level. And that fine-tuning is just such a difficult part and a vital example of why you need playtesters. And playtesters not just from inside your own crowd, but people who've never played your game before.
Yeah, there's a big advantage I have there, actually. So what I do is I teach at a game college, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have these 18, 19 to 23-year-olds who I teach because they're doing a graduate, they're doing a bachelor's course at my college. And I also, once a week, I teach at a school, right? Like school kids, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade. So I actually teach something called creator software. So I teach them Photoshop. I teach them Blender. I teach them how to make their own website. You know, so I go in there once a week and I teach them. And I take my goals. Hey, who wants to play a game? And they're like, me. And then that is the most amazing thing. When there are a bunch of 7th and 8th graders in a class passing your phone between them and playing the game. And I just look, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That is really how I've been able to tune the game with these kids, you know. And sometimes I just, you know, I live in a condo complex that has thousands of kids, right? And I have a couple of kids as well. So I'll go down and, you know, I'll be sitting in the park and there'll be a bunch of kids. I'll be like, hey kids, you want to play a game? They're like, sure, yeah, play this. And I hand them my phone, I hand them my iPad, and I watch them play. I see the mistakes they make. I see what they like, what their assumptions are about the game. I see what they ask me. And I've been doing that for a year and a half now. You know, I've been doing that a lot over a year and a half. And that has helped me, like, that's been my tuning, you know, from like really early on in the game, when the game looked terrible. You know, I was a little bit ashamed of letting them play, but I still did. And you know, that's helped me to really tune my game showing it to all these kids in random playgrounds and in classes. So that's been a big part of my design and iteration process.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and again, it sounds with a game like Parvlight that can't really easily be explained. Having all these eyes on the game will obviously it has helped you with fine-tuning it and being able to explain it to someone who, again, may look at this game and go, what is this? I've never seen anything like it. And getting those fresh eyes on it is just very critical for that process.
Yes, fresh. And it's really hard to get fresh eyes, you know?
Yes.
And it's not just fresh eyes. Like, it takes a while to figure out what to ask, what to look for. Because mostly, people just want praise, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People just, you know, subconsciously, we want people to say, dude, awesome game. Mm-hmm. This is so nice. It's what we crave, you know, and it's what we look for. But that's not what I'm looking for. It's the points where my mind works in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and the player's mind works in a different way. I have to find that point of divergence and say, I'm thinking like this, but the player isn't.
Mm-hmm.
My assumptions are not the player's assumptions. So those particular points, you know, it takes a while to see that. It takes a while to find that and to actually observe someone playing your game and see the right thing and not look for play. That part is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point. Yeah. And I know that before the cast, we talked about how you're enjoying the content on Game Wisdom. I have a post. By the time you folks are listening to it, it should hopefully be up. But I'm currently working on a post talking about effective ways of teaching game mechanics. Three very important questions you should ask and what the player should essentially is thinking about while they're trying to learn a game. And I think that's going to be a really interesting tie-in to this kind of discussion when the post goes up.
I look forward to it, sure.
Yeah. Now then, well, this has definitely been a great cast, and I feel that we could easily talk for the next few hours. But
yeah,
one of the other interesting things about when I have these international casts is the time difference. I know it's like 9.5 hours where you are. So I know it's definitely getting late. And again, we could talk. There's so many more topics. I would really love to have you back on for talking more about this, especially more of a general cast. I can introduce you to my contributor to Game Wisdom, so I'm sure he would love to talk to you as well, and to get more experience with talking to people outside of the United States who are heavily invested in the game industry.
I'm having fun, Mike. I'm just call me whenever, dude. I'm right here.
Awesome. Now, for our final topic, and the one that was really the big reason I want to have you on to discuss, and as we've been sort of hemming and hawing about over this cast, has been the challenges with developing Parvlight for the mobile market, and then finally that decision to take it to the PC. As I talked about all the way at the beginning of this cast, you wrote several posts on this topic, which again, for those of you listening, should be in the notes below. But you talked about two very specific problems that you had with making Parvlight and getting it to appeal to the mobile audience and that decision to eventually move it to the PC. So the first one I want to talk about is the fact that you wrote a post regarding the fact that people were complaining that the main character was a girl. And you talked about the fact that a lot of people said either change it to a boy or we don't want the game. And I find that very surprising as by the fact that Parvlight was originally a mobile game, which from the outside I thought that the mobile market was going to be a lot more inclusive by the fact that they want to make these games appeal as broadly as possible. But obviously from your own experience and standpoint, that is probably not the case with having a female character.
Well, yeah, I mean, to start with, my motivation to actually cast a female character, it was pretty, I mean, I have a little girl, you know, and I was like, you know what, so the next game, I'm going to have a little girl in my game, you know, it wasn't a big deal at all. I was like, you know, it would be nice to have a little girl with pigtails running around, As simple as that. That was it. So I'm like, I'm gonna have a little girl in my game. And at some point, I realized how big a deal that was, you know. And to be honest, where I come from in India, it's kind of messed up in the sense that we have a lot of female feticide, you know. It's like millions and millions of girls every year they die before they are born because they're girls, you know, and society generally prefers males. So we have a huge gender gap. Like we should be having an equal number of males and females, particularly in some parts of the country, and it's not the case. There aren't enough women, you know, and that's a serious problem. And it just felt like the same thing was being repeated. Because I mean, here's the thing: if you're a developer and you work in a game, it becomes part of your life, and a character that you create, she becomes. I mean, this might sound odd to some people, but she's family. She's actually this game character. I created her. She's my little girl, you know. And if someone says, "Hey, you know, we don't want your little girl," someone's literally telling me to kill my little girl, you know. And it was unbelievable that someone would do that, you know. And but to be honest, probably if I was on the other side of the coin, if I was an investor, or if I was a business executive at a mobile company, I mean, I understand their point of view, but it's still messed up. You know, the truth of the matter is that mobile is so crowded that there is absolutely 0% scope for error. Like you can't mess it up. You know what I mean? You probably paying tons of money for like 10 seconds of eyeballs. You know what I mean? And action games are played by males generally, you know, and males identify with other males. You know what I mean? And these are all truths. These are facts, right? So when you have such a short player attention span, when you're paying through your nose to get a few seconds in front of a player, and you're going to put something that a player statistically might not like, then that's a no. You know, because you're not presenting the game mechanics. You're just showing a prospective player a brief snapshot. You know, and that is where it's a fact that I mean, gender imbalance and gender I forget the word
Inequality.
gender stereotyping.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah. So gender stereotyping really exists. You know, we know it exists. And boys don't like being associated with girls. You know, it's possible that if a little boy is playing a game as a little girl, someone makes fun of him, you know, and they don't like that. You know what I mean? That really exists. But
Oh, yeah.
how big a deal it was, it came out when I tried to market this game. It's a really big deal. And it's not just a problem in India, it's a problem all over the world. It's a
Yes.
problem with gamers. It's a problem with males. We are very, very afraid of losing our masculinity. You know, we are not secure in our masculinity. It's very fragile. It's really fragile, you know. And that came out, and that just made me more determined to actually keep her. You know, I wanted to prove a point that you can play as a girl and still be masculine. And it can still be a really challenging and hard game. You can play as a little girl running around with bobbing pigtails. You know, you can do it. So, yes, that's why we stuck to our guns.
And definitely a whole lot there that's very interesting to talk about. And I agree with you all. There's definitely an issue with that, with gender inequality and gender stereotyping. I mean, hell, we've had so many discussions and pieces in the United States over the last 2, 3 years, which have talked about the underbelly of the game industry. And it is definitely a major problem. And again, growing up as a boy, I saw like the same thing. You have boys' toys, you know, separate from girl toys, and the two shall never meet, or if they do meet, it's going to cause a huge problem. And if a girl wants to play with a boy's toy, it's like, oh my God, you can't do that. And while there have been some strides in that front, it's still a very slow-moving process because there's just generations of that kind of mentality that has become cemented for a lot of people. And I honestly don't know, you know, what will be that tipping point, what will start to finally make things go, you know, in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's actually there's an imbalance there as well. You know, girls don't have a problem playing male characters because they're just so used to it. They're just so used to game characters being males. So they're like, all right, I'll play this game and it's gonna be a male character. I don't have a problem. There's no shame. There's no fear of losing femininity while playing a male character. It's fine. You know, they don't care. Because they're so damn used to it, they don't care. But the other way, there's this, oh my God, do I need to play a girl? And especially, I mean, Tara is completely unsexualized. Like, there is, you know, she's not a sexualized character at all. We've been very, very, very caught. She's just a little girl. That's what she is. You know what I mean? And, I mean, there are female characters, right? But a vast majority of those female characters are hypersexualized, which kind of makes it worse for me, you know? So, yeah, there's definitely this imbalance of losing masculinity and femininity, you know? That's a big point in here.
And the fact that people, again, like, argue about playing a female character versus a male character, I think is a huge example of the fact that there is still that issue. There is a game, or there's a post, I believe, earlier in 2015 from a, I can't, the game's name escapes me, but it's a open world exploration or survival game, and they don't allow players to choose their starting character. You can't decide if you're a male or a female or what your skin color is. The game just decides that for you and create, and the game just gives you a random character. And there are people complain about, oh, I don't identify as a black male, or I don't identify as a woman. How dare you force that on me? And as you're saying, Raul, a lot of guys feel like they get is like their masculinity is getting attacked, but women don't care because they've been dealing with it for since like the inception of video games. They've always been playing as male characters, so it just seems like another day in the office for them.
Yep, precisely. That's it. Yep.
Now, another part, and this is the other post you wrote about in Gamma Sutra, and what we've been talking about over the length of this cast has been when you decide to make Birth of Light a PC game versus a mobile one. And we talked earlier about the state of the game industry in India and the focus on mobile development. For people who haven't read the post, even though we'll have a link to it, could you talk a little bit? I don't know if a lot of these discussions are NDA, but what were some of like the major issues or some of the hurdles you were running across with getting the game released on the mobile?
I'm not sure I understood the hurdles that we were coming across getting the game released on mobile previously. Well, I mean, primarily, it's mobile is a very, especially if you're making a freemium game, is heavily data driven, right? So you put the game out there for free, right? And you put analytics in there. And you see how much money the game is earning, right? So, which means that for a freemium game, you need to soft launch. You need to soft launch the game. You need to, you know, spend a good amount of money on seeing how your data is. How are you making money at all? You know, when your players are coming in, how long are they playing? How much income are you generating by in-app purchases, by ads, and is it worth it at all? You know, so the biggest hurdle for us was that. It's straightforward. It's a chunk of change. It's like a bunch of $100 bills. Someone needs to put on the table and say, okay, I'm going to take a chance in this game and see how it performs, you know? And no one, I mean, we did find some people, but they were like, change the character, mm-hmm. you know, and change this and change that. And we knew for a fact that we had something complex, mm-hmm. but good. You know, we knew that there was a core of players on mobile. There is a core of players, probably millions of players on mobile who would really enjoy playing this game. But the problem was that it would cost too much to actually put this game in front of them. For them to discover this game would be really, really hard. You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, I still haven't given up on mobile for sure. Like, I know for a fact that there will be many, many, many players with mobile phones who would enjoy playing this game a lot. But it's just that getting them to find it is beyond our capability at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, a really telling factor is if you look at the App Store. And you look at the reviews and you look at the comments on mobile, the comments are like, this game is awesome, 5 stars, or this game sucks, mm-hmm. 0 stars, and this game is really buggy, 1 star, or this game is addictive, I love it. You know, it's completely one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. They're like 1 or 2 line, very, very few reviews, and maybe 1 or 2 line reviews. And if you go on Steam and you look at the reviews by players, it's a different universe. You see look at the engagement. I mean, I find it amazing that there are players who would play the game for 6.5 hours mm-hmm. and write 3 pages of review.
Oh, yes.
And not recommend it. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, that's just bizarre. You've spent 7 hours playing a game and you've written a whole ream of review talking about it and you don't recommend it. So, I mean, even though you don't recommend it, mm-hmm. you have gotten into the game in so much depth. You know, it shows a complete different level of engagement with a video game, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just different planets altogether. And so that's why now we are hugely motivated to look at our game with a microscope and say, okay, let's polish the hell out of this thing. You know, let's not leave anything to chance, because we have players who are really, really going to look at it with a microscope, yes. You know. And we didn't have that for mobile. People were just going to engage with it at a completely superficial level and be gone, you know. So now our motivations are completely different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a really good point you just made, Raul, regarding the metrics-driven side of the mobile industry. Again, they're focusing a lot on getting someone hooked within 3 to 5 seconds. They want to make it instantly appealing. They want to, you know, hit every checkpoint on the list. And that goes back to, again, they want a male character because, well, the audience identifies with a male character for the most part. Well, we need to have a male character for everything because we want to get someone hooked immediately. And as you're saying, with that metrics driven, they want to make sure that people are viewing the ads. They want to make sure the in-app purchases are going to keep people spending money. And it just makes things very metrics driven. But at the same time, it also limits what you can do with the platform. While for those of you listening to this, Kaz, this post will be up, but the day that we're recording this, I just literally made a post talking about the comparison between the video game industry and the gambling industry, specifically with slot machine design, and how it's that same kind of thinking that you can't make something outside the box because they don't want that. They don't want to have things different. No one's going to buy a slot machine that has a higher chance at paying out or requires more thinking or more player input. They just want something to get the money in, get the consumer out. And that just limits what you can and can't do with that platform. And as we talked about over the cast with Borderlights gameplay, it's not something that can easily fit into the same scope as every other mobile game or every other social game that's on the platform.
Yes, true. I mean, the thing is that and it's really interesting that you say. I don't think I told you about this. So I have a day job, you know, and in my day job, I'm the chief of user experience of a company that makes slot games, right? So in the last 3 or 4 months, I have actually, side by side, my day job, I've actually been getting really heavily into slot games and the gambling industry. And the really interesting thing is that gambling game industry has actually reached a point of saturation where they're really, everyone's really tired of the same old stuff. So what's happening is that a lot of casual game mechanics, a lot of skill-based game mechanics are getting into the slots game industry. If you know, there's a lot of that happening because they have actually reached a point of saturation. And everyone's fed up. It's just the same thing. So I've actually been, and I've been drawing really hard about my skill game design experience. But the funny thing is that you need to hide the luck. I actually need to disguise luck. It's like I need to make it seem like it's a skill game, but it's not. It's actually just a luck game. You know, so people want to do something skill based in gambling games, but it's actually just luck. You know, so disguising that has been a big thing. But then, I mean, you're right. There is the winners, the little guys who are really doing good work, are taking risks. You know, but they have like a 10 or 15% risk budget. You know, it's like I'm going to spend 85% of my time doing something safe, but I'm going to spend 15% of my time and money and energy on doing something that could fail, but that could be the next big thing. You know, that's really important. And the leading companies, the good companies are doing that. I've definitely noted that.
Yep. And regarding like the gambling industry, especially with dealing with casinos, I bet that's something very similar to a mobile developer trying to approach a mobile publisher. Because the casinos, they care about the numbers. They want to know, you know, what's the buyout? How much money do they expect to make from each of these slot machines? And as you just said, Errol, it is very saturated. I mean, a point of the post I just wrote is that I just came back from Las Vegas to visit family. So I got to stay at a hotel casino, and it is definitely saturated there. The entire ground floor is just nothing but slot machines.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, there is definitely a huge movement. But if you think of video slots have changed things a lot, right? Lots of people who used to play traditional slots are actually moving on to video slots. And we are in the middle of a huge change right now, especially in the gambling industry. Because they've reached that level of saturation that they're just throwing up their hand and saying, you know, we need something new here. We really need something new here. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, for sure. I've been working on lots of new concepts. Maybe in another podcast, I would really love to discuss some of the slot game mechanics that that I've been thinking about. Yeah, that's a whole new topic.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to talk about. As part of the post, I'm not a fan of gambling mechanics in game design, but I'm really curious to hear, we'll definitely have to talk about that at a later point, about how the gambling industry is trying to learn from video games, and about trying to add more control or more ways for the player to interact with it, but still having that luck factor. I think that'll definitely be a fascinating cast, because again, that's something that, as someone who looks at this from the outside, from the games, I'm not a fan of gambling mechanics, but if the game industry can learn more from games and try to apply some of those lessons, that could be very interesting. And as you just said, it's going to be very challenging to get that to an industry that has been dealing with the same sense of design, that same saturation over, I can't even think how many years it's been now.
Yeah, it's just even in, I mean, the only place that I was really world weary when I came to Steam. You know, I was really cynical as a developer when I came to Steam. It's just been a couple of months, and since I've been back on Steam, And since I've started engaging with PC players, it's kind of, I have a little bit of hope now. You know, I really have a sense of hope. Like, it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. There really are players who care about games, you know, who really look at games in depth and who are willing to pay and who are willing to explore a game, you know. So I have hope now, Josh, seriously. Mm-hmm. The last couple of months coming back to ski, Steam at home. So it has been really good for me, mm-hmm. for us.
Good. Excuse me. Now, another big question that I want to ask you all, and then we'll start to wrap things up. We'll have to be transitioning Bird of Light from being a strictly mobile game to the PC. As we talked about before the cast, you're going to be spending at least a month or so fine-tuning and making the game more appealing to the Steam audience. And as you said a few minutes ago, you're going over every inch of the game. You want to make this as best as you can because of the fact that the Steam audience is a lot more critical compared to the mobile fans. I think your example of paragraphs for reviews is a great example. I have a friend who literally writes like 2 to 3 pages worth of content, and that goes into his Steam reviews. They're just massive things. So my question for you then is, now that you are taking Bird of Light and making a PC game, what are some, I guess, elements from the mobile side that you're either stripping out or altering to make it appealing to a PC fan?
That's a really, really good question. There are some things that we had put in there. We made them pretty hard, and we realized that it was kind of too hard. So we actually put in some cheats that you could buy your way out of. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the map, right, you have in the puzzle, what we would do is we would, for a fee or for a number of tokens, we would allow players to actually, we would give them the solutions to the level. So they're like, man, this puzzle is too hard. Just tell me the answer. And so they could actually make an in-app purchase, and they could actually buy their way out of solving those puzzles. It would still be hard. Like, they would still have to run the level, but they would actually have... they would actually be able to buy their way out of solving the puzzle. We would remove that completely. Okay. You know, like, that option has been completely removed. And so what's gone back is that the game is actually going back to what it originally was. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of, we are reclaiming the game as such. We are reclaiming the, we are not apologetic about the difficulty anymore. You know, we had kind of diluted the difficulty quite a bit. So now we are reclaiming some of that difficulty. We're not being apologetic about the difficulty of the game. I mean, the high point, you know, we're keeping the difficult highs. We're keeping the spikes pretty high. And another big advantage is that this is actually a game in which you require a field of vision. So when you're running around corners, it really helps to be able to see a little wider. And on a mobile screen, you couldn't. Like, you would turn the corner and you would bump into something, you know, and that was terrible. People didn't like that. Now that we are on a wide screen, we are in landscape, that's great. You can actually look around corners. And some people have even told us it would be great on VR, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we are embracing once again. And it's basically the story was the writing. I mean, I love to write. And whether I'm writing a blog or I'm writing dialogue in a game, the dialogue was kind of short and superficial for mobile. And now I'm like, all right, you know, now I can, okay, not write a ton, but I can definitely put a lot more of what I'm thinking, what the characters are thinking, into the game, you know. So we are making the storyline, we're making the dialogue between the characters a little more intense, a little more dark. We are undiluting the difficulty. We're reclaiming the difficulty of the game, and Yeah, man, it's just retaking the game back to what it originally was. That's it.
Yeah. And regarding your decision to remove the in-app purchase for hints or level skips, I think that was a very smart move. Even if the game has been fine-tuned down, I know a lot of gamers, especially PC gamers, I should say, immediately a red flag goes up if they see any kind of monetized advantages, whether it's, you know, spend $1 to get extra ammo, or, again, 50 cents to skip a level or get a puzzle solution. The second they see that, they immediately think, oh, the developer intentionally made the game that hard so that I'm forced to spend the money, whether or not that may be the case. And that goes back to our discussion earlier with fine-tuning that difficulty. The person feels that it's the game that's screwing them, or it's the game that's making things difficult and it's not them, they're going to, you know, just get fed up and quit. And again, anything that can give them that hint or let them know about that is usually a bad sign. Another point we could easily spend another hour on would be a lot of PC gamers' distrust and despisement of quote-unquote pay-to-win mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when I was doing, with you know, when you're doing mobile, you do something that you're not happy about, you know. So this whole, it wasn't, so we never reached a point where it was play to win, but it was pay to win, but it was pay to make it a little easier, you know. But we still weren't happy about that. Because, I mean, what's the point of putting in a puzzle, right, and allowing the player to buy their way out of that puzzle? There's inherent contradiction in there, you know? And now, I mean, I'm thinking that at some point, I'm going to release the game for mobile. I'm going to release a premium game. I'm not releasing a free game. Well, I mean, at this point, that's the plan. But I don't think I'm going to release a free game. I think I'm going to keep the character. I'm going to have a game that you pay once, and that's it, you know? So for sure, I mean, that is something we were not happy about. We were not comfortable about, but we needed to do it because, you know, we needed to make some money from it. And yeah, so that's gone. Hopefully that's history. No more pay to make the game easier.
And another point about that, when you have those level skips, is that it can actually hurt the design of the game. Because if someone doesn't learn, I'm sorry, in a lot of sandbox or puzzle-based games, when you build upon mechanics through level by level, if a player skips level 2, let's say because it's too difficult, if you're using level 2 as a springboard to teach a player something else for level 3, guess what? When they get to level 3, they're going to be just as frustrated because they haven't learned what they needed to solve that level previously. And then it just is a downward slope that the player's going to get frustrated, and either A, they're going to spend a lot more money, or they're going to say, I'm not learning this game, you know, screw it, I'm uninstalling it.
Yeah, true. I mean, honestly, at this point, George, mobile is broken, man. You know, mobile is seriously broken, and something needs to happen to fix that. It's really sad the way mobile is these days. It's cynical. There's no joy in it for the developers. There's no joy in it for the publishers, and even players. You know, it's bad. It's not good at all. So it'll kind of sort itself out, but you know, for now, it's not a nice space to be at all as a developer.
Unless you're willing to, again, fit within those very neatly arranged slots or those very similar designs. So whatever is the current hot trend, unless you're able to make a game similar to it or a clone of it, it's not going to make as much money. And when the industry is metrics-driven like that, it really hurts the chance to make something stand out or something different.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, everyone doesn't have the same motivations, right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of really motivated to make the games I want, you know, and I can't. It's really difficult for me to make a game which is, you know, from a spreadsheet. But then having said that, there are people who are perfectly happy doing that.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, totally, there's no judging them. And there are players who specifically look for games for a couple of minutes, you know, to just, you know, blow some steam and just play a game that they're very familiar with. And that's fine. You know, I don't begrudge them that. It's just that if you're a creator who gets pleasure from what you create, and I mean, I'm a player who plays challenging games, right? And as a developer, I can't do something which is easy, you know? It's kind of like I'm the same kind of developer as I am player. I mean, I need something hard. I need something challenging me. That challenges me, something that pushes me as a developer, as a designer. And I need something that's kind of hard to do. So it's just the way I am, you know? Everyone's not like that. So mobile will survive, but to actually push the medium, to take the medium, to make the medium do things that it hasn't been done before, like that's not happening right now. You know, it's not really happening.
Yeah. And this goes back to a post I made about 2-3 weeks ago where I constantly see a lot of mobile developers, a lot of mobile-centric people talk about, you know, everyone should join the mobile industry. It's the next big wave. It's going to be, you know, you're going to make millions of dollars. You're going to have tons of fans and stuff like that. And honestly, I just don't see that in the current state of the market. As you're saying, Raul, a lot of it is very cynical. A lot of it is very much driven by these metrics. So it makes it very hard to stand out. And it also has me very concerned about a lot of developers, you know, immediately jumping on the mobile bandwagon and finding that either A, their game is too unique and no one wants to publish it, or B, it's so similar that it's never going to stand out from either games similar to it or make any ripples against the big name ones like Kim Kardashian's Hollywood, Game of War, and a lot of those other very, you know, massive titles on the market at the moment.
Moths to a flame, Josh. Mm-hmm. It's exactly like that. Yeah. You know, I mean, mobile developers, first-time developers, I mean, it's mobile is like this flame, you know, this bright burning candles, and there's like mm-hmm. thousands and thousands of these little moths mm-hmm. circling round and round and round, and they just want to burn themselves. Mm-hmm. You know,
yes.
They're spending all this time and all this effort and all this energy. And the really good ones, the motivated ones, they'll survive. You know, they'll find a way of making it work. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But a vast majority, every time there's a Flappy Bird and that makes $10 million, you know, you have 1,000 more developers that jump in. Hey,
yes.
That's going to be me. You know, mm-hmm. that's going to be mean. And they realize, no, like that's not going to happen. But
yeah.
it's sad, man. It's exactly like Moths to a Flame. And yeah, so I have no idea what's going to happen in the mobile space.
Yeah. And that actually was going to be one of my last questions to you all about your current thoughts on the mobile market. And again, that is another topic we could, that's another 2-3 hour discussion easily there.
Oh, yeah.
But I know we have certainly gone past our time for the cast, so we'll begin to wrap things up. I have just a few general wrap-up questions for you all, and then we'll say goodnight. So, the first one then is, for people currently listening to this cast, what is, I guess, the estimated release time for Bird of Light?
I would say late May 2016. Definitely. It would be up on Greenlight sometime second half of May 2016.
Okay. And as you were saying earlier, even though the game has been altered and redesigned to be a PC first title, you are also planning on then taking that version and releasing in the mobile space at some point in the future.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're definitely looking at console after PC.
Okay.
Right. Because it's I totally see this on a Nintendo platform,
yeah,
like the Wii. You know, it's very typical of something that a Wii U or a Wii player would like, for sure.
Yeah.
Or even Xbox or PlayStation. So we're definitely going to be looking at console first after PC, and way after that we're going to look at going back to mobile.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to be curious to get your impressions when that time comes about how the redesign of Burlite is doing on the mobile market. As you're saying, as you're rebuilding the game, making it more PC and by extent Wii and console friendly, I'm really curious to see how that's going to translate once it gets back in the hands of the mobile market. Because as we were just saying, there's definitely some hurdles that the market has at the moment. And I'll be curious to get your thoughts on that when the time comes.
Yeah, I mean, one thing's for sure. We have decided as a team to embrace the core gamer in us.
Yeah.
You know, we are not ashamed of that anymore. You know, at one point, we were, you know what, this is too hard. Even if we do release it for mobile, we are going to release it for that small niche core mobile audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think we're going to go back to trying to make everybody happy.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to do that anymore. You know, we've kind of learned that lesson, and, you know, doesn't matter what happens. You know, the game needs to be true to what it really is. So we are not going to try and dumb it down or really oversimplify or casualize the game, if such a word exists anymore. Like, that's not going to happen. We're probably going to be like pretty unapologetic about what the game really is when we do decide to go back to mobile.
Yeah. You're making the game that you want to make. You want to keep it to as close to your vision as possible.
Exactly. We are done with compromising on that.
Yeah. And that's definitely a great attitude to have. And an important trait of being a game designer is being able to figure out what your core mechanic is or what the foundation of your game is and celebrating that. If you dilute that or alter it, it's going to infer on every aspect of your title.
True. That's a lesson. That's a lesson that we've learned recently.
Yeah. Well, Raul, this has definitely been an amazing cast, and it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I know right now it's probably getting close to midnight, or maybe is midnight around your time. So I don't want to keep you into the wee hours of the mornings where you are. I could just sit here and talk for the next 3 hours, but I don't want you falling asleep at the keyboard. So,
No. I'm bright. My mind is racing after this podcast, Josh. It's been really good. And yeah, I mean, it was, you know, you very rarely actually get to sit and talk like this, you know. So it was really good, man. I'm looking forward at some point to talk about other things, talk about slot games, gambling games, the mobile, you know, yeah, definitely we should do this again.
Yeah, for sure. I also have to introduce you to my new contributor, James. I want to have this cast be a one-on-one since we were talking about something so specific, but it will be definitely great to have all three of us on to talk about these topics for the next one.
For sure, Josh.
So, with all that said, we're going to wrap things up here. Again, Raul, it's been great talking to you, and yeah, we'll definitely keep in touch because I would love to have you back on in a few weeks to talk about some of these other topics.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh. It was really good, and I'm definitely going to be spreading the word about Game Wisdom, and look forward to sharing the post and being a part of the show again. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you again for the kind words, Raul. It's always great to talk to developers and talk to people who love these kinds of conversations, who love talking about the industry in this way. It's the reason why I wanted to grow Game Wisdom and the reason why I want to spread the word and get as many people excited about it as possible. So, I guess my final question then, and to wrap this cast up with then, is for you, Raul, do you have any final thoughts on anything we've talked about or anything you would like to say to any fans who might be listening to the cast?
I would just say that I'm really excited about putting this game out there. I've never made something so distinctive. It's, you know, it's something really close to my heart, you know, and there's a lot in there. There's a lot of depth, and it also speaks. It's what I have to say to the world, and I'm saying it through video game, not just me, it's me and my team. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So whoever wants to play the game, it's just enjoy it. You know, we hope you enjoy it. And we're really looking forward to whatever people have to say, good, bad, whatever. It's just we've been working for so long. We're just really keen to hear what people have to say. And we're going to try and keep an open and positive mind about it. So, yeah, I guess that's it.
Great. I think that's an excellent settlement to end this cast on. So, for everyone listening, we're going to end this episode of the Perceptive Podcast here. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, as always, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. We are always looking for new guests. As you can obviously tell by these casts, I love talking about design in the industry. So if you're a student, enthusiast, designer, or anyone else, definitely shoot me a message. If you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom's Patreon campaign to help keep the site ad-free and allow me to keep putting out great content, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking that little Patreon banner on the top of the front page. Any donations would be greatly appreciated as it will all go towards keeping Game Wisdom going. Lastly, be sure to subscribe on Twitch and Twitter under GW Blazer to get the latest updates when new content goes up. And as always, there is the growing Game Wisdom YouTube channel where you'll find Let's Plays, video spotlights, and supplemental video reviews there. There's a link to that on the front page, and it should be very easy to find me on YouTube now. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning in to this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.